episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Welcome to Slate House Publishing Presents Lit Bits.
He stole my line again.
I'm taking over.
This is Jeremy.
You don't
welcome.
Even, you don't even have a script.
It's all up here, man.
We can
it's
insert
all up
in
here.
Post.
Yeah, insert a post of hollow sound. It's all up here, man.
A cave drip.
I don't need a script. I am the script.
Where we're going, we don't need scripts.
Samuel Dashiell?
Dashiell Hammett, yeah.
Was an American author of hard-boiled detective novels. Now, what is a hard-boiled?
All right.
He had a lot of eggs.
Okay, we... I knew it was coming.
That's an upcoming pun Monday. It's like I wanted to write hard-boiled fiction, but I ran out of eggs.
Oh, it's so Easterly, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn it.
What distinguishes a hard-boiled detective novel versus a detective novel? And I think for this answer, we kind of have to understand the cultural moment that Dash Hammett is writing in, right? Because most of his stuff was written in the late 1920s, early 1930s.
So to give you guys a colorful image, bankers at this time were throwing themselves out windows.
I don't think that actually happened.
Let's play with the tall tales there for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there is like, that's the urban legend, right? Like toward the end of the 1920s,
there
was a huge stock market crash in 1928 that led to the Great Depression. The early years of the Depression were really tough on like a lot of literature. A lot of,
I mean, let's be fair, the Depression was tough on a lot of people. Just the literature suffered.
You're absolutely right. It was tough on a lot of people.
We only have feelings for those people.
But one of the things that I think we do see is kind of a resilience, if you will, of some pop culture, right? Because I think people, especially, we come back to this question of fiction, right? In hard times, I think people do need stories, right?
Sure, yeah.
And I think that a lot of depression literature...
I mean, just look at all the stories
explore some of that.
In fiction that came out of the last presidency.
Yeah. All right, look how many Netflix shows came out during the pandemic.
Yeah. I think Almakatsu has... quite a bit to say about the last person.
She did. If you haven't heard that episode yet, folks, check it out.
it's pretty great. I think what distinguishes a hard-boiled detective versus any other kind of detective is that detective stories toward the turn of the century and into the 20s and 30s, I think really were characterized more by what we might call like an armchair detective. There's a lot of pop culture in this moment of people who would kind of sit back and solve problems or solve mysteries just for the fun of it, right? It was like it's a hobby. So we see a lot of like hobbyist criminologists crop up in pop media at this time.
So that's like in a way kind of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I know he was like, he had a lot of stories, but he wasn't a part of the police force. He was like this... just somebody who had studied this kind of craft, and he used his powers of deduction to help the police and solve these crimes.
I think we also have to look to authors like Agatha Christie, who for a long time was writing stories like the Miss Marple series or Hercule Poirot, right? These Archetypal?
Sure.
Didn't we go through this archetypal?
We did.
Archetypal is the adjective.
Archetype is
the noun.
Right. Yeah.
So what are you trying to say? Noun or adjectives? Archetypal.
Yeah. These archetypal characters.
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. Right. I think that what makes them what they are, right, is this notion that it's not really a job for them so much as just like it's something they do, right? It's a hobby.
Yeah.
Poirot, I think he actually was a real detective, but he never really takes a case for money, right? He typically just kind of becomes involved and he just does it for fun. Miss Marple was not a detective, right? She's just someone who's very observative.
Right.
Observative.
That's a word, right?
Observant.
Yeah, observant. There we
go. Observant.
See, with great power comes great responsibility not to fuck up the lines. I've learned
you
this.
You know what?
This is and why now it's Trevor in the hot seat.
We've got a prize out there for only, whenever we get things wrong.
Only for when Jeremy gets things wrong.
Oh, well, you know.
But we should update the prize now. If Trevor's going to take over some of the podcasting hosting responsibilities, then the prize has to extend to him.
So. I like observative.
Observative?
It's interesting.
Observative.
Yeah. It reminds me of the...
You know what? I'm going to look up that word right now.
Go for it.
See if it's a
It reminds word. Me of the lawyer on Seinfeld that was spoofing like the O.J. Simpson lawyer. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, there's been so many jokes
about
the O.J. Simpson lawyer.
Yeah, he's like always making up words.
It is a word. Observative. Paying close attention to detail. Watchful or heedful.
What does observant mean? The exact same thing.
It's the same thing.
Everything is in the dictionary now. Did you notice that?
I need my aha moment.
That's a go. You win. You win that one.
All right.
We're not
playing Scrabble, though, so let's...
Disorientated is in the dictionary.
Disorientated. Actually, that makes sense.
That's like a kick in the balls.
That's unscrupulative.
I hate that so much.
That's unscrupulative.
Unscrupulative.
Anyway.
So hard boiled.
So the hard boiled detective, I think, is in contrast with these other detectives. It is someone who is a detective like by actual labor, by actual trade.
They accept jobs. They do it.
This is their job. Right. This is what they do. And I think specifically that the hard boiled detective is a kind of character that influenced a lot of like later noir film and noir stories in that they kind of like coexist in this seedy underbelly of the real world,
right?
And they have kind of a foot in both spheres, a foot in the legitimate and a foot in the underworld. That kind of characterizes the hard-boiled detective.
Nice. Okay. Cool.
So Dash Hammett.
Clear that up.
Yeah, Dash Hammett is one of the, one of the best novelists of the 20th century. One of the best writers of the 20th century.
We wouldn't call him prolific, though, would we?
No, I don't think he really was. I mean, maybe he was in his moment.
Right.
But not necessarily prolific when we look at the total sum of his work. Because the total sum of his work is, five novels and then, handful of short stories. So we can go through his biography, though. He was born in 1894, died in 1961. He was raised in Maryland.
So he didn't live that long.
He did not. He was only, 65?
Yeah.
Yeah.
64 or something like that. That's relatively young.
Maybe a little.
I mean, back then that wasn't as young.
It wasn't. Yeah. I'm not.
Our math skills aren't great.
So he went by Dashiell?
Yeah, his first name was Samuel. Yeah.
Dashiell Hammett. Maybe he was 67.
67.
He didn't want to be confused with Judge Samuel Hammett of Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Oh, is that right?
Is that a real dude?
No, I just made that up.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
okay, fun.
Sorry to Sam Hammett out in Kenosha.
Sam Hammett.
I'm a fiction writer, guys. This is what I do.
I want to call him Ham Sandwich now.
Ham Sandwich.
Sam Hammett.
That'd be pretty funny.
What book did you bring us today, Ham Sandwich?
Anyway, he was raised in Maryland. He left school at 13. He served as an operative for the Pinkerton National Detective Agency from 1915 until early 1922, and during that time he also served in World War I. He grew pretty disillusioned with Pinkerton after the agency coordinated some strike breaking efforts in the 20s, and in 1918 he enlisted and served in the Motor Ambulance Corps during World War I, right?
Yeah.
Overseas, he contracted contracted Spanish flu and tuberculosis.
Wow. Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a bad combination.
He spent most of his time during World War I as a patient in Tacoma, Washington.
Been to Tacoma. It's a good place to spend as a patient.
Good place to be a patient.
Were you a patient in Tacoma, Washington?
No, I just saw some.
Why do I even write a script?
See, now we're on board. Now we're on the same plane here.
Now you get it.
Now you get it.
I don't derail you nearly as often.
Oh, no, but it's so much fun when I derail you, so.
I'm going to have another blow-up moment. Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, hang on to your fucking pants.
Now people are going to understand why you blew up last week.
Can we start calling them Herms?
Oh, man. Guys, I can't do the podcast today. I got the Herms.
The Herms are after me.
The Herms are on my ass again.
Oh, God.
Now I just picture some like really old man like, get back here. Oh, no, it's Herm.
It's the Herms.
Go ahead, Trevor. Sorry about that.
Who's Josephine Dolan?
I was talking about his love life.
A nurse. She's a nurse.
Yeah, she was a nurse. She married Dash in 1921 in San Francisco, and most of Dash Hammett's fiction takes place in San Francisco as a result, right? That's kind of where he lived. He had two daughters with Dolan, Mary Jane and Josephine, in 1921 and 1926, respectively. He got separated from the family on account of tuberculosis. The government actually stepped in and said, you can't live with your wife and daughters because of the tuberculosis.
Right.
Because they'll contract it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And this was pre-antibiotics for tuberculosis.
For that sort of disease, yeah.
Tuberculosis, I think, was like a centuries-long plague. I mean, I think people suffered, like, it's one that we don't talk about a lot, but it was definitely an epidemic.
It was really, really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was scary. Everybody was terrified of that.
With it for his entire life.
That sucks. Right. It's basically your lungs start falling apart, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially. So he was separated from the family. His marriage disintegrated after that, although he continued to write and use the money from his writing to support his family. For many years afterwards.
Hmm.
He was first published in 1922 in a pulp magazine called The Smart Set. He wrote most of his fiction while he was in San Francisco in the 1920s. He's known for his authentic sounding dialogue. Most of his early work appeared in Black Mask magazine, which was Black Mask, I think, is one of the maybe two pulp magazines that was really well regarded in the literary field for the kind of stuff that they published. Looking back, the academy, right, academia, really does not care much for a lot of the pulp literature that was released during this time. Dash Hammett is one of those figures who stands out and I think even in its moment, its cultural moment, the people who really looked down on a lot of like common working class literature, like what the pulp literature would have been, still felt like Black Mask was probably the best of any of these magazines.
Surviving to this day, I would say that, you know, Dash Hammett and Raymond Chandler maybe are the most well-regarded in academia.
Yeah, Ray Chandler and Dash Hammett for sure. And Ray Chandler kind of came after Dash Hammett.
Right.
And he continued to write, I think, even into the 1960s. But, you know, Dash Hammett, as we'll kind of see, was kind of shoved out of the limelight for a little bit of time because of some other stuff that was going on. Right. So due to a financial dispute about some back pay, Hammett left Black Mask in 1926 for a period of just like a couple months, right? He wrote some ad copy for a jeweler in San Francisco, and then the new editor of Black Mask brought him back in summer 1926, where he contracted a whole bunch of stories that would lead into, I think, the most successful period of writing for Hammett. His first four novels were originally serialized in Black Mask magazine. I think those are the books that we most talk about, right? Maltese Falcon was one of these books that was originally serialized in, right. in Black Mass Max.
So was The Thin Man?
Yep. I believe it was Red Harvest, Thin Man, Dane Curse, and Maltese Falcon. Maybe okay. not in that order. Yeah. He became romantically involved with Lillian Hellman in 1929, and they remained partners for the next 30 years. And this is really important because Lillian Hellman is another really interesting literary figure who I think was also very well connected to a lot of interesting figures in literature at this time.
Not the Hellman-Mannes dynasty, though.
Not to my knowledge.
Who knows, man?
Don't make me Google that.
Was it the same Hellmans?
Was it the same Hellmans?
Probably not. I'm just going out on a limb and saying probably not. His final novel, The Thin Man, was published in 1934. He moved in with Hellman in the 1940s in upstate New York. In 1935, Hammett joined the League of American Writers, which was a pretty well-known communist organization. And he officially joined the Communist Party in 1937.
Uh-oh.
He was associated with a number of known communists, including Lillian Hellman, which, you know, was his partner for 30 years, Alexander Trachtenberg, Louis Untermeyer, and Arthur Miller.
Oh.
Yeah. He wrote a screenplay in 1942 for the film Watch on the Rhine, which was based on one of Hellman's plays. That one received an Academy Award nomination, although the screenplay award that year went to Casablanca.
Ah.
Who remembers that movie?
I mean, come on. Yeah. If you're gonna choose, I mean,
yeah. He enlisted again in 1942, served in the Aleutian Islands, but was transferred because of his radicalism. They found out that he was communist, and of course, that kind of changed their mind about who they wanted him to be.
They McCarthyized him.
They had no illusions on who they wanted there.
During World War II, that was a bad pun.
Oh, man.
That was a good pun. That was a good pun.
Wow.
I didn't even get it until you opened up your arms and started looking around the room. Like,
golly. I'm a seethe about that for a couple hours.
We'll come back to it.
He developed emphysema during World War II. And then he returned to returned post-World War II to his political activism. And this is where things kind of get crazy, right? He partnered up with the Civil Rights Congress to create a bail fund to assist political activists, specifically within the Communist Party in the United States, right?
So Senator McCarthy was a big fan of his then.
Right, yeah. The CRC, the Civil Rights Congress, right, was flagged as a communist front group by the U.S. Attorney General pretty shortly after its construction. The CRC gained attention in 1949 when it bailed out 11 men indicted under the Smith Act for criminal conspiracy. Ugh. Against the United States. Four of them fled the country in 1951 rather than return to federal authorities after, you know, they were released on bail and their courses or their cases were continued in the courts of the United States.
Wow.
So when these four kind of like ran off, there was a congressional investigation into these CRC to discover what kind of occurred there. Hammett testified in 1951 in front of Congress, but refused to cooperate, citing the Fifth Amendment. And as a result, he was found guilty of contempt of court and sent to a federal penitentiary in West Virginia, where he stayed for a couple of years.
Can you cite the Fifth Amendment when you're testifying to Congress?
I mean, No.
No.
Well, you can.
I mean, you can cite anything you want.
I mean, because that's not a criminal, you know, venue.
Yeah. So I wonder. So he refused to participate, right? Basically, because they were kind of pressuring him, like, you know, because he was part of the construction of this bail fund, which ended up, you know, springing these 11 dudes, and then, you know, four of them fled the country rather than face, you know, charges.
Right. Damn.
Yeah, so he refused to talk about, you know, his role, and specifically to name any of the other people at the CRC that were, you know, responsible for the creation and maintenance of this bail fund, because he was really involved in this organization, and I think he was actually kind of the gatekeeper for this bail fund, right? He watched over it. He was the treasurer,
right?
Whatever.
Right.
Yeah, so he was sent to jail. His books were taken out of print in the 1950s due to his part in the legal proceedings against the CRC, as well as his communism. A lien on his income was tallied by the IRS for back taxes that they said he owed since 1943. He testified again in 1953 to the House Un-American Activities Committee about his activities, but refused to cooperate. No action was taken at that point, but he was officially blacklisted as a result. For most of his life, he was an alcoholic. He gave it up in 1948 after he was kind of pressured by his doctor to stop. He was sick for the majority of his life, becoming more and more of a hermit until his death, and he died in 1961 of lung cancer. He was buried in Arlington National Cemetery as a war veteran.
It makes me think he breathed in some shit during those two wars.
I mean, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, he already had tuberculosis. As we know, everybody smoked tobacco during this period of time. And he was a prolific smoker. He developed not just tuberculosis, but also emphysema.
Yeah.
And then died of lung cancer.
Tuberculosis, emphysema, and then lung cancer. Man, he ran the whole gamut.
He put his lungs to use.
Yeah.
Right? He did not hold back at all.
Oh.
His published work, like we said, is only about five novels. Red Harvest was published in 1929. The Dane Curse, 1930. Maltese Falcon, 1930. The Glass Key, 1931. The Thin Man, 1934. He wrote a bunch of short stories from 1922 to 1934. He did Watch on the Rhine, the screenplay, in 1943. He did a daily comic strip feature for King Features Syndicate.
He was pretty busy.
Yeah, in 1934. And he's got some original story credits for four films from 1941 to 1939.
Right.
After that period in time, though... he kind of gave up writing, and it's really interesting.
But I think what gets me though is that you say like after that time he gave up writing, but he was very, very busy in this political activism.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And people don't. I mean, we learn about in history like the effects of McCarthyism and stuff on citizens, but we don't know how much that ruined people's lives, how much it destroyed their lives. Just even like so for somebody like Dash Hammett, who is obviously a confessed communist, there were people who were caught up in this stuff that were never even a part of it. And it was just, they made the wrong enemy. And so it was almost like the Salem witch trials. They're like named.
I also think it ruined
their lives.
I also think that we really have to understand, communism and the American idea of communism as being like very, what's the word I'm looking for?
When Americans
propagandized?
Yeah, when Americans hear communism, they automatically think Russia, they think Stalin, they think, oh, that's
the
new enemy.
They think people who are coming, you know, sweeping in to try to steal your land and steal your stuff, right? Which is completely not true. It is not in keeping with the ideals of American communists at the time. Right.
Russia and the Soviet Union were part of Marxism, which is an interpretation of communism, but it isn't communism.
Well, and I think we also should state, like, Marxism is not what ends up, you know, creating these dictatorships in Europe, right?
Right.
Like, Marxism is, if you actually read any of the tenets of Marxism, it does not lead to you know, the creation of the governments in Russia or other spots in Europe, right? Yeah. That's not to say that they don't claim some aspect of Marxism, right? But I think that as happens a lot of the time, right, a lot of these, I think these cultural ideas are adopted by radicals who then only pay lip service to what they say they're about, and then they go off and do their own thing.
Right.
So, yeah, so let's, I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to add to that, but let's go ahead and jump on the Maltese Falcon then, because that's specifically kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah, Maltese Falcon, I think, is a fascinating book.
Right.
And it's probably the best example out there on, you know, the subject of hard-boiled detective novels, right? It's routinely cited. It's like probably the best. I don't even think it's necessarily Hammett's best book. I think his best book for me is probably Red Harvest. But Maltese Falcon is the one that basically everybody knows.
Right.
I
don't know. Do you want to give like a lowdown of the story? Like kind of...
Yeah, the summary.
The summary?
Right? Yeah. You read the book.
Yeah,
too,
I read
right?
the book.
Yeah,
yep.
So the summary, I think, the book is really about this detective named Sam Spade. And Sam Spade gets a visit from a girl who wants to contract him for a job. She makes up a phony story about what the job is, where basically he and his partner believe that they're just supposed to tail this guy because this guy has been hanging out with this girl's sister, and they're trying to figure out where the sister is. That's, you know, typical private detective work, right?
Right.
So Spade's partner goes off to investigate this guy, you know, tail this guy, and a couple hours later turns up dead. And Spade starts trying to figure out, all right, what happened to my partner? He finds out that the guy that his partner was tailing was also shot multiple times and shows up dead a couple hours later.
No.
And begins to realize that there is a much bigger issue at play. And he starts down this road of trying to figure out what the actual stakes are behind this contract, you know, he was made to fulfill. And as he investigates, he uncovers a conspiracy by a number of different backstabbing individuals who are searching for what they call the Maltese Falcon. It is a statuette with some history of basically leading back several hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
And the statuette was supposed to be given to like one of the Spanish kings or something, like King Charles or something like that, as tribute. This statue of a falcon or whatever that's made of like a bunch of gold and rubies or whatever.
Right.
And it has this weird rich history. And these criminals are trying to get their hands on the falcon. It serves kind of as a MacGuffin.
Right, right.
It's just the thing that everybody wants. And so Sam kind of finds himself embroiled in this like very, very conflictory intrigue as he's trying to set straight, you know, who killed his partner, why did they kill his partner, and why is this damn MacGuffin that everybody's looking for so important?
And one of the tenets to me for these kinds of stories that he kind of sets up here is he makes the stakes even more personal for Spade by having the cops initially suspect him.
Right. Yeah, and the cops suspect him.
So he's trying to find the murderer, but he's also suspected and kind of intimately wrapped up in this.
And he's trying to deal with a whole bunch of stuff, right? Like he's been sleeping with his partner's wife. That comes out in the wash. He becomes romantically entwined with Bridget O'Shaughnessy, the girl who comes to him with this fake story and originally contracts him.
Yep.
He becomes, you know, kind of accidentally embroiled with intrigue of this guy, Gutman, who's looking for the Falcon, and another dude, Joe Cairo, who was previously kind of a partner of O'Shaughnessy, mm-hmm. who, you know, kind of again, O'Shaughnessy is so unreliable. She's so unreliable. She kind of stabs everybody in the back and
or shoots them. Spoiler alert.
Can we spoil a book that is?
We ask us ourselves this every 80 years episode. Old.
80 years old.
It's an open-ended debate. Can you spoil something?
If an 80-year-old book falls in the forest, can you spoil it?
It's not even 80 years old. It's 92 years old at this point.
Oh man.
Yeah.
So you were talking. You were telling me about how the things that Sam Spade observes is relevant to his ability to transcend class and work within the different classes that he's forced to work with.
This is one of the things that I think makes this book so damn good and why we should read it, right? Yeah. Because I think no other writer in America at this time, I think, was really as concerned with kind of depicting class and depicting kind of problems of class in such a unique way, right? Dash Hammett's characters, if you look at his detectives, they're constantly remarking on the way that they dress, the way that they speak, the way that they make themselves up, right? And all of these are class signifiers, right? He's constantly using his characters and their narrative, right, to inspect the intersection of, you know, class, race, gender, what have you. And I think that gives us a really unique view of kind of America at that moment in time, right? Yeah. So I think the stuff that I really latch on to with his work, you know, for one thing, his vocabulary, the style of narration that he uses, it's not super complicated linguistically.
You and I compared it to Hemingway when we talked about it.
I think a comparison to Hemingway is really appropriate.
But I think that comparison also lends itself to that idea that Hemingway spoke of, which was that iceberg theory. Like, as plain as it seems on the surface, if you really look at it, it gets deeper and deeper. And that's something, like, I want to continue with you on this conversation, but I want to bring up when I talk about the craft side of it, like kind of how this is represented.
Yeah. And I think what's fascinating is that, you know, Black Mask magazine was really built for or created for a working class readership.
Yeah.
And so the language that's used, I think, by Hammett and other authors in Black Mask is really related to that working class readership.
Right.
We cannot divorce that class consciousness from this sort of story. Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important, too, that we see these detectives as working class fellows, right? As working class writers or not writers, working class characters.
Right.
Right.
Very blue collar.
Very blue collar. Right. They're hitting the pavement like their detection is labor to them.
Yeah.
Right. It is how they feed themselves. It is how they make their way through. And as we see, you know, from Sam Spade's apartment and stuff like that, it's a very Spartan living.
Oh, right? Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of excess.
Yep.
Another thing that I think is really interesting is the way in which Hammett's characters code switch as they talk to the different characters.
Do we want to define code switching for the audience real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
So code switching is... basically, so in the simplest of linguistic terms, it's when you combine or switch between dialects or ideas of language within like the single character switches. So a common reference we see in this, if you ever watched that older Adam Sandler movie Spanglish, where the idea is like this bilingual person switches. This is different from what Hammett does, but it's in the same kind of universe. So it's this idea of like a bilingual person. And if you talk to them and they're like a native non-speaker of English, but they're speaking English, they can code switch between the two languages. And they'll put in like, say, some Spanish to help kind of, cause they can't think of the English word. But then you also see this too, like with people who are native English speakers, but maybe they speak different dialects. So like,
And I think even without regards to dialectic speaking or right. speech, right? I think it's also important to kind of note, like, you code switch depending on who you're talking to.
Exactly.
You'll speak differently to your mother than you might speak to your friends.
Even right. if it's subtle.
Yeah. There, we see this a lot. Things, yeah. I mean, a lot of Black communities talk about code switching a lot because mm-hmm. the way that they might speak to an audience of their peers or an audience of their friends yep. is completely different to how they might speak to a white audience.
Right, because there's right? this pressure exactly. to do so. Yeah.
My stepfather was a radio DJ, and in his business, I would watch him do this like in live time. Like he would, if he was doing something that was very presentable, very professional, then he would have almost this Midwestern no accent about him. But then if he was trying to garner business from a local community member there in the central Arkansas,
yep.
he would code switch a little bit and adopt that dialect mm-hmm. to kind of reach that person as he's talking to
right.
them.
Yeah. yeah.
And I think it was almost on a subconscious level, but he was still able right. to do that. But all that encompasses the idea of code switching.
When yeah. I go back to Texas, I think I probably
yeah.
do it too.
We all do it. Everybody does it.
Yeah, everybody does
Shoot.
It.
Shoot.
But it, yeah. it's one of those things that is very, I think, underrepresented in literature.
Yep.
And this is one of the reasons why I think Dash Hammett rings out as so authentic feeling.
Yeah.
Because his character... or his characters code switch depending on the situation that they're in.
Yep.
And a lot of the time, the code switching has everything to do with class and class distinction.
Right.
I don't think that we can divorce any of the things that Hammett is doing from his communist ideals, right? And class, I think, is at the forefront of the consciousness that he's trying to develop for his readers.
Right.
So the code switching is really, really important. The same with his descriptions of people. A lot of the descriptors are centered on their clothing. It's centered on what they carry with them. It's centered on, you know, the way that they portray themselves to the rest of the world, because that is, you know, clothing, that's sense of personal style, whatever, right? That is a class consciousness thing.
Right.
Right.
You dress differently when you go to an Easter Sunday, you know, gathering than you dress, you know, just on your casual weekend fling.
Take me, for example. I wear a white hoodie and khaki shorts
right.
to the studio. But if I'm going to be professional, I'll wear my white hoodie and black shorts. Or if right. I'm going to the gym, I wear my white hoodie and some spandex.
Yeah, it's important to be able to make these dramatic changes.
The spandex is the most
from black to upsetting from black part of that. You know, he's from San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
I was. This is kind of weird. I was watching like 1911 colorized footage of San Francisco. It was just like a street. You know, just action on the streets.
Yeah.
And every single person was just to the nines with their clothes.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Every person had a hat. The ladies all had these dresses. And my daughter was asking me, like, why are they all so dressed up? And it has a lot to do with this class, you know, type of mentality.
Yeah.
Like, people don't realize, like, when people started taking planes commercially, that was like a huge deal. And people would dress up. They'd get dressed to the nines to go take their plane ride to wherever. And now it's like, yeah, no, they're not. It's like,
I mean, you also would have like full course meals, you know, on a flight, and everybody smoked and had coffee.
Oh, yeah. The good old days.
Now it feels like entertainment.
The good old days of smoking on airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So the thing that I want to mention, so kind of what we're talking about here, if you've never read The Maltese Falcon and you're hearing all of this, one thing you might assume, you being correct, is that this is like a first-person narrative because everything is so close. But it's actually written in something called third-person. And with third-person, we tend to, it's almost like instinctual. We want to say, oh, it's third-person omniscient. And I've argued before that third-person omniscient is not really a thing. Third-person omniscient, when it is a thing, when it is done, is very, very confusing for the reader. It's mm-hmm. not something that can easily be followed. Well, what Dashiell Hammett here does, and this is brilliant. It's called close third person or free and direct style. And what this is it's still the third person narration. It's still he said, she said kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But he attaches the narrator very, very closely to Sam Spade.
Yeah.
So the things that the narrator is reflecting on in these descriptions of people, That's really Sam Spade seeing these things. Yeah, he's noticing these
Sam's
things.
It's Sam's voice.
It's Sam's voice throughout this whole thing. And one thing you and I pointed out was that the narrator doesn't tell us that Sam Spade at one point is being followed, right?
Right.
We just kind of learn it as the narration is spotting things, and we're told Sam Spade sees like this kid or something. And
we're not even told that right. Spade sees these things. It's just there's a kid on the corner.
Yeah.
The same kids, you know, like looking at a haberdasher store as Spade's eating lunch.
Right. And it's never like Sam Spade does this or Sam Spade sees this. That kind of narration is actually right. far, far removed from it.
Right. It's Sam Spade's eating lunch. There's a kid on the corner.
Yeah.
It's really, really
it's brilliant.
It's well done. It's so economical.
Right.
And again, you know, to your point, this close third person perspective, I think the term that I learned for it is focalization, right? Focalization yeah. being you have a third person narrator that is indistinct, right? Like there is not necessarily a narrator who is telling you the story, because I think we can see some books have a third person narrator, although that third person narrator is certainly a character from somewhere in the story.
So if we want to get really technical, we could talk about homodiegetic versus heterodiegetic narrators and fixed focalizers versus variable focalizers versus multiple focalizers with the Riggios and reflectors. But I don't think we want to go there. We don't want to
We don't need to go that deep right now.
That's we cool, can, right? though. We right. can. But I can go
I
that
think
deep.
The focalization for this story is definitely Sam
definitely.
Spade.
Yeah, we're it's seeing the story voice. Through Sam Spade's right. lens.
But overall, all those devices are in reference to what's happening in the scene and who notices it, who's aware
but
of
but
what
it does, because yeah, one thing we talked about too is when you realize who Sam Spade is, you realize how intelligent he is. So now not only is this description and is this narration reflecting on class themes, but it's also revealing to us who the character is himself and showing us just how damn smart he is.
Right.
I mean,
there's so what I love about this book is that it's like a lean 217 pages.
Yeah, it's not long. Right? You could read it in a
it's
weekend.
It's not very long. And yet there's so much information that he'll pack into a dialogue with characters. It's very frequently Spade will start a conversation with someone not knowing exactly what it is that he's saying.
Right.
But someone else will start talking to Spade as if he knows what he's talking about. And as a result, Spade gets way more information from somebody.
Right.
And it's absolutely brilliant because there's so little exposition in this story. You uncover the same information that Spade has as the characters are talking to him.
I don't remember. I don't think we get any kind of, because there's such things as dialogue beats and dialogue tags. And I want to explain that to the reader or the listener really quickly. Dialogue tags are like the he said, she said stuff.
Yeah.
Dialogue beats are actions or behaviors paired with that. So it's like he said this, you know, somebody quotes something and then like a dialogue beat would be like, he took a drink of coffee or it might be a thought inserted inside the character's head. And we don't get a lot of those thoughts inserted inside the character. I don't think we get any.
No,
it's just,
there are very, very few.
Right.
I'm a proponent of dialogue beats.
I am too.
I really don't like tags very much when I read. I love dialogue beats.
Because you can
though.
Infer more with the beats.
Yeah, and I mean, it's all.
Like, here's an example.
It
so like
mimic a kind of like a more natural setting. Right.
An example of like a dialogue tag might be, you better get away from her, he said, or he whispered, or he said angrily or something.
Right.
Versus, you better get away from her, close quotes, his face reddened, his fist pounded on the desk.
Give a description of what.
You get more, the beat gives you more, it doesn't tell us what to think or what to feel or what the character is thinking and feeling. It shows us through the descriptors.
And Hammett definitely uses more of the dialogue beats than he does the dialogue
tags. Because you can infer more than one emotion with the beat, right? Because he said angrily. Well, he's angry, but he said while he nervously tapped his pencil.
Right.
That could be angry, nervous, you know, a lot of different things.
But even
all at
then,
once.
We get long passages of dialogue where two characters are just talking to each other, and I think it's again the economy with which he delivers all of this dialogue is so fascinating. And yeah. there's so little exposition. I mean, there's really only one part where one of the characters exposits what's really going on.
Yeah.
To Spade. And that's right. very late in the book. And suddenly we understand the stakes. And from that point forward, we can move on with the resolution of the story.
And I almost feel like that was more for the reader than it's for Spade. Like Spade right. already knows this. It's, like, right. it's almost like confirmation for him.
So the book,
you know, well,
I don't know.
The one spot I'm talking about is when Gutman explains the entire history of the Maltese Falcon.
Okay. Gotcha.
And,
yeah.
and that yeah. is, that's the expository dialogue that we need that Spade needs.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's hilarious how he'll go in and talk to his lawyer, for example, and the lawyer starts trying to explain stuff to Spade, and he's like, skip it. I fucking understand that part. Let's move on.
Yeah.
And I think that's so great because, for one, it keeps your reader on the level, right? It doesn't treat your reader like your reader's dumb because your reader has read this whole fucking story too. I don't need a recap
exactly.
of everything I just
exactly.
read.
Yeah.
Right? And neither does Spade. So if Spade's like, cut the shit, get to the good stuff. You know, like, tell me something I don't know.
He's speaking kind of for the reader,
it's
right?
It's so yeah. brilliant. Yeah. It's so well done.
So this book could have been 300 plus pages if he hadn't been as expeditious in
exactly.
saving information,
yeah.
right?
But yeah, but as a result, cool. I think...
And I feel like if it were written today, it probably would be about 400 pages.
It probably would.
Because
I don't know that there are many writers out there. Like, period.
Not only that, but I don't think the publishing... And just like an editor at a publishing house, not necessarily our publishing house, but at one of the big four or whatever,
yeah.
be like, oh, no, you need to explain more to your reader here. And
yeah.
Right.
Just straight up, I don't even think from the past century there is anybody who does this as well as Spade did.
Yeah.
I think that an argument could be made that Ray Chandler is, I mean, he's an excellent writer. Do not get me wrong.
I mean, Hemingway did, but not within the same genre. Like,
yeah. I mean, yeah. But I think that when we talk Hemingway or we talk Ray Chandler or we talk Dash Hammett, I mean, we are talking about three individuals who are truly in a field of their own.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that there aren't writers who, you know, do dialogue tagging or something like that aren't great writers. I'm just saying when it comes to this kind of a style, when it comes to this particular skill, I don't think there is anyone who can hold a candle to what Dash Hammett was doing. Artistically, I think his work... This is my thesis of the episode. You ready? This is my hot take of the episode. I think that artistically speaking, Dash Hammett to me... is like technical jazz. It's there's nothing quite like it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that Dash Hammett and his style and by extension, the hard-boiled detective is as American and distinctly American a form of art as jazz is.
And they both arose around the same. They were both coming to prominence in the same time.
It's the same cultural influences, I think, that create this artistic moment.
Right.
And I do not think that you can, I don't think you can divorce Dash Hammett and hard-boiled detective fiction from the specific American landscape that created it. Just like I don't think that you can remove jazz. I think jazz is a purely American art form.
I agree.
And I think that Dash Hammett's hard-boiled detective fiction, and by extension, a lot of hard-boiled detective fiction, I think is very distinctly an American art form.
Nice. I agree. Nice. I agree.
That's a good take. Good
so basically,
take.
Hopefully, if we haven't convinced you to read this fucking novel or to explore Dash Hammett and his other works, then you're—I don't know—I don't
you're
have
doing
a word.
Yourself a disservice.
That's a nice way to put it.
You're fucking up your whole life.
You're fucking up your whole life. So I think—is that all we want to say about it?
I think so. Hammett himself was a really interesting figure. He's a figure that I don't think we talk enough about. And I think that his literature is one of those, kind of collections of American literary art.
Give him what happened to him in a personal life, too. I mean, this feels the whole story, the whole universe of Dash Hammett, the detective thriller, the rise of jazz, how all this kind of culminates together feels very not just the art that's inspired by this. It's all like very 20th century Americana.
I think that, yes.
Like exactly. Between the McCarthyism and the, you know, everything that happened to him. This is Americana. This
the
is America.
The fact that you can taste the smoke in the room when a detective is talking to a perp, right? I think that is really a tribute to how much of a cultural mainstay, right, this is kind of created for us.
Yep, exactly. All right, so we are, thank you for that episode, Trevor. I think you did a wonderful job with that.
Oh, yes, of course.
We are going to be at StokerCon, or we are at, I don't know, when does this air?
Okay, this airs after StokerCon.
We were at StokerCon.
We were at StokerCon. We saw your faces.
We're
You're
confused.
All so beautiful. And we had a really great time. It was wonderful.
I feel like Donnie Darko. I'm just in multiple realities all at once.
I just,
I feel like you're jinxing yourself talking about, like, we went and we had a great time. Nothing bad happened at all.
We were not murdered.
Easy for
that's
us.
For sure. Let's the Herbs did not track us down.
The Herbs.
Yeah, let's stop right there before we jinx ourselves.
Hey, you know what is out for people to buy right now?
What, Trevor?
What?
K.A. Huff's Ground Control.
We own Ground Control.
Oh, that's right.
We got it.
Ground Control to K.A. Huff.
Book trailer right there.
I have to sing something at the end of every episode.
Yeah, you do. We also have Curtis Harrell's Melpomene's Garden.
Yep. That is out now.
So
as
Ground
well.
Control is grounded sci-fi. Ground Control is
grounded
sci-fi.
I would call it grounded sci-fi. Yeah. It truly is a magnificent novel.
Terrific.
I loved it when it was a book from Lights Out, Inc. I love it even more now that it is a book from
Property
Slay
House
Publishing.
Naturally.
That's right. We acquired the rights to it. We're so excited about this book. We really want you to read it. And hey, if you do read it, go on back through our backlog of episodes and you can listen to our interview with K.A. Huff.
Yep. We've got another anthology coming out this year. I think submissions open in July.
Yep. Tales of Slay House 2022.
We have
opening for submissions July 1st.
Three other titles that are coming soon that we'll talk more about as we get further along in those projects.
Indeed.
We have the Summer of Universal Horror. Is that what we're going to call
that
it?
That is coming up. That is right on the horizon. That is right. And the series that we're heading into for this summer is a look at all of the Universal Horror monster movies. We're talking Dracula. We're talking The Mummy. We're talking Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, Lon Chaney Jr., I mean, we are getting into some really, really good stuff.
Anything that inspired a Rob Zombie album, we'll get into it, right?
Essentially, sure.
Anything that has inspired horror and the, you know.
I think it's going to be really fun because this stuff, I mean, this is horror that spanned from the 1930s into the 1950s.
Yes.
Some pre-code horror.
Yep.
Some post-code horror. And I think it's phenomenal stuff. We're going to have a lot of fun watching it, a lot of fun reviewing these movies, talking about these movies. And our intent is to, every episode, look at one or two of these monster movie films and talk about why they are so special and why you should watch along with us this summer.
Yep.
Yes. All right. If you want to check out anything else Wayne Howard Studios is doing, we got patreon.com/Wayne Howard. We do music and CGI and all that cool stuff, as well as great podcasts.
You guys are working on us, working with us too on some book trailers.
We
and
got
some
cool
dramatic readings on patreon.com/Slayhouse. You can also find some dramatic readings. You'll find some exclusive illustrations, portraits of the Slay siblings. You'll find some hot takes.
And we haven't even talked about it.
It's about to get cool. It's about to get real cool.
Yeah, starting in July, we are going to have two original fiction audio readings, audio narrations that we performed here in the studio.
Yep.
Yes.
So excited about that.
So excited. Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, that's a wrap.